yesterday for Don Schumann, who was described as maybe in the beginning stages of dementia. Early this morning, family members called authorities to say he got lost while driving, but was now home, safe and sound. Now, 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD sports and weather. Major League Baseball, Brewers beat the Cardinals 5-4. Cubs and Cincinnati postponed because of weather. White Sox lose to Toronto 14-5. Tonight, the Brewers play the Cardinals again at Miller Park. Cubs are off. The White Sox play again in Toronto. NBA, the Bucks beat Boston 106-102. Bulls beat Charlotte 120-114. Both teams are off tonight. And in the NHL, the Blackhawks were off last night. They skate in St. Louis tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Wednesday, April the 4th. Should be cloudy, windy, and cold. Today's high 36. We'll see wind gusts up to 25 miles per hour today. Right now, wind from the west-northwest at 12. It is 25 degrees in Racine, 26 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. Jack and Drea, proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. 1 week from today, next Wednesday, April 11th, a very special event is going to be going on at the University of Wisconsin Parkside called Building Bridges as We Talk, Knowing Our Neighbors. It will begin with a reception at 5 o'clock, followed by a presentation and dialogue 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. in the Student Center Ballroom. And the special guest for this event is UW-Madison political science professor Dr. Catherine Kramer, responsible for one of the most discussed books about politics in recent years, a book called The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker. Professor Kramer, who is originally from Wisconsin, was really anxious to better understand what was driving rural voters in Wisconsin to make some of the political choices that they were. And she ultimately decided that the best way to figure this out was to simply listen to them. And so she embarked on what turned out to be an intensive and extensive listening project carried out over the course of 5 years, from 2007 to 2012, as she fanned out to small communities all across the state and sought out small informal groups that would get together quite regularly. And she would join them and mostly listen and hear what they had to say. Out of those listening sessions, she began to understand something which she likes to call rural consciousness that many of these rural voters shared. And at the heart of that rural consciousness was a sense of resentment, a sense that rural Wisconsin was not getting its fair share, not its fair share of attention from lawmakers and leaders in Madison, not receiving their fair share of resources, especially tax dollars, and not receiving their fair share of respect, feeling like they simply were not understood or appreciated. The idea being those folks in Madison making all the decisions don't know us, don't understand us, and don't even like us. And Dr. Kramer came to believe that this sense of intense resentment was really the lens through which many of these voters were viewing the world and making their political choices. One of the things that she spells out in her book, The Politics of Resentment, is that resentment has two elements that are very important for us to understand, that resentment is public and resentment is stubborn. I asked her to explain.
Well, resentment is a kind of emotion or sentiment that it's okay to say out loud. It's social psychologists have compared it to, say, jealousy or envy, which sometimes reflects poorly on the feeler, the person with the emotion. But resentment is something that it tends to be the case that people are okay sharing with the other people around them. And that both, I mean, that is one way in which it can be politically really useful, because you can talk about it and you can draw attention to it. You can say, you're right, you're not getting your fair share, and you're right to be upset. And it also, it's stubborn in that it takes a long time to change such a sentiment, because partly because it's very much rooted in perception. So, and by that I mean, I'm sure some of your listeners are saying right now, yeah, but it's not the case that they don't actually get their fair share of resources. And it actually is the case that rural communities on a per capita basis get a little bit more of state taxpayer dollars and a little bit more of federal taxpayer dollars than people in urban areas. But that doesn't matter on some level for the sentiment of resentment. It's driven by perceptions, and it's hard to turn. It takes a long time to turn those perceptions around.
So for instance, here in Wisconsin, you were saying that even when, for instance, public employees suffered what amounted to a pretty painful and significant reversal of their fortune, right, so to speak, that didn't wipe away these feelings of resentment, at least among a lot of the people that you talked about.
That's for sure, right? Because now, I mean, let's say, for example, public school teachers in communities across the state. Now, is it suddenly the case that people are saying, okay, now the balance is evened out a bit, and now they're paying more into the collective pot, and so we're not resenting them anymore? That really hasn't happened. I mean, I still hear the tune of they have summers off, they still have, you know, pensions, and people still feeling like public employees in the smaller communities around the state have a better quality of life, are more well off than private employees, and that I still hear that sentiment.
So that resentment has real staying power, and that's important for us to understand. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Catherine Kramer, a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, and we are talking about her very important book called The Politics of Resentment. Back to the way in which you went about studying this. As you've already touched on, between 2007 and 2012, you traveled all around the state of Wisconsin to speak to small informal groups, and for the most part spoke with small informal groups that would themselves sort of self-convene on a very regular basis. So this would be kind of the curmudgeons in the corner at Burger King that meet every morning over coffee to discuss the world, and sometimes groups of women speaking at a family style restaurant, and in many cases groups that were kind of a mixture, and all around the state. Was it just mathematics that made you want to talk and listen to Wisconsinites in these group settings? I mean, was it an efficient way to hear from more of them? Or was there something about the group dynamic that also drew you to this possibility?
I was definitely interested in the group dynamic, because I had learned over time that when you listen to people talk with the folks that they know and that they're used to talking with, you can see a lot more of how people draw on their sense of who they are in the world and the kind of people that they are to interpret politics. And that's identity. That's the, you know, people using a sense of, so what kind of person am I? What kind of beliefs are appropriate for someone like me? And as people have conversations with one another about politics, you can sort of hear them asking each other those questions and making claims about you know, oh, people like us, we don't support this type of person or that type of policy. We don't hold this kind of value. And so I'm really interested in political conversations within groups.
Explain how you went about finding these groups, because we're talking about communities in the far-flung corners of the state, and I'm sure in many cases, probably in most cases, communities you yourself had never visited, maybe communities you'd never even heard of before. Logistically, how did you go about tracking down these groups?
Sure. Well, I started out by printing off a bunch of maps of different characteristics of the state, just economic, political, agricultural, demographic in terms of ethnic heritage and racial composition. And looking across all those maps, I basically wanted to confirm that there's certain areas of the state, you know, yes, there's a Fox River Valley. Yes, there's a northwest corner that's distinctive. Green Bay is somewhat unique unto itself, et cetera. And then in each of those places, I sampled at least one big place and one small place. And then when I had sampled communities across the state, there were, 27 in all, I called up local newspaper editors and people in county extension offices in our awesome UW Extension Service. And I just said, you know, where in such and such Wisconsin do people get together on a regular basis that I might get access to, that I could invite myself into? And sometimes they weren't sure what I was talking about. And then I would say, you know, like, is there a diner in town where there's a group of people? Oh, sure. I know, you know, and sometimes people knew exactly what I was talking about. And basically they ended up referring to me, as you said, basically morning coffee clutches of people who get together pretty much every day. And, you know, gas stations were really commonplace, and diners and restaurants. And sometimes I had to get a little bit more creative, spend time in places of worship or ask more people in the community. Sometimes it took a while and people were meeting in more private places. But I basically asked people in the communities who I figured knew those places really well.
And then explain sort of the overture by which you would typically try to join these groups.
Sure.
This is, I think, fascinating in and of itself, and also fascinating in terms of how you, generally speaking, were received.
Sure. Well, I chuckle to myself because it just sounds so funny. But in reality, it sounds weirder than it was. So basically what I did was, let's say someone had told me that, okay, at 5:30 a.m. in Joe's Gas and Sip, there's going to be a group of folks sitting around the coffee urns or standing around the coffee urns shooting the breeze. And so then I would find the closest Super 8 to that community and stay there the night before and wake up early, drive over, take a deep breath, walk in and say, hi, I'm Kathy from the UW-Madison. Do you mind if I join you this morning? and they would laugh a little, you know, or say something like, sure, we got nothing better to do, and generally welcome me in. And they, I think, I'm pretty sure the first time I visited with each of the groups, they thought I was a little nuts. But then I said as genuinely as I could, as quickly as I could, no, I'm really, really, I'm here to listen to you. I'm really interested in what you all are talking about these days and what you're concerned about. And here's my business card. Here's a token of my appreciation, like a football schedule or a pen. And do you mind if I turn on my recorder and tell me what are the big concerns around here these days? And then we would go from there. And it was very interesting and revealing to me to see the way people opened up as soon as they realized that I really was there to listen to them, to not to sell them anything. I wasn't running for office. I wasn't trying to convince them of anything. And my sense is that people both enjoyed and appreciated the conversations. Of course, I might not know of the very critical things they might have said once I left, but I think people really opened up.
Right. And of course, you tell us that once in a while you actually would overhear some of their comments about...
Yeah, like, oh, here comes trouble. That was my favorite one.
Right, right. As I read about how you went about doing this, honestly, one of the things that surprised me a little bit was that, and I hope you won't misinterpret this question.
Sure.
But, I mean, there is no question but that your primary purpose was to listen. And yet, it is not that you settled down into a seat around the table at McDonald's or wherever this was happening and then just sat there and only listened. I mean, you did, in a sense, insert yourself into the proceedings, at least to the extent of actually asking them questions, or at least on most occasions you did. And I'm just curious why you decided to do it in that way, because you also could have made the choice to really be just a fly on the wall. What was your thinking there?
Efficiency, to be honest, meaning, so I wanted to spend time with a wide range of people, and so I struck a balance between getting breadth across a variety of types of communities and at the same time spending enough time in each of them that I got a sense of what was going on in the lives of the people that I was spending time with. So I say efficiency because I basically had a few hours with a given group a few times a year. And so ideally, I mean, it would have been very revealing to have spent, say, several months in each place and to really just as much as possible be a fly on the wall. But I didn't have that kind of time, unfortunately.
Right. I suppose the other thing, too, is you didn't have time to sit there and listen to them talk about, Fred, how's that new coffee maker working out, or how does Sarah like life at the pharmacy school, or I mean, you really needed the time to be.
Oh yeah, but there, yeah, I mean, I often, because you learn a lot from that too, right? You learn a lot from what people bring up on their own. So I tried in each of these conversations to kind of strike a balance between letting. Just listening to the topics that people brought up on their own and then encouraging them to talk about a few things that I really wanted to hear them express their thoughts on. So I did enjoy their conversations about the other things going on in their lives. And so I did try to allow a lot of that to happen.
Sure. But at the same time, that helps us understand why it was important to pose certain questions and make sure certain important matters were addressed. I think a really interesting shift that apparently occurred over the course of time was in terms of the sort of choices you would make about what you wore. And it sounds like part of what was going on there was a sense of how much you wanted to, in a sense, obscure who you were and who you were about. And on the other hand, they knew who you were. I mean, right off the bat, you said who you were and where you came from and why you were there. But can you just say a word about this matter of, for instance, how you dressed and how you carried yourself?
Sure. And it definitely has evolved over time as I've matured as a researcher, because I think starting out in my head, I had a sense that I was basically doing a survey, but just in person in a group setting with more flexibility in the content of the topics. And from that perspective, it was important for me to be as neutral and as absolutely the same across each setting as possible. And so I wore the same thing as much as possible to every group. But as time went on, here's another thing I'll just say I should have known from the beginning, but something I learned over time was that I that's kind of ridiculous because, of course, I'm not doing a survey. I'm not kind of a scientific instrument collecting data. And that what's helpful about this method is that I am there as a human being, as my own self, interacting with them, having a relationship with them, and engaging in a conversation. So at the beginning, I was wearing the same thing to every group, but now, and I've gone back to many of these groups in the past few years, I understand now that the most important thing is just to be genuine. And so I still don't want to wear things to draw a lot of attention to myself. I don't want to be the center of the conversation as much as I want them to talk about certain things. The spotlight is on them, not on me. So I don't wear anything too vibrant or crazy. but I also don't dress in a way that I wouldn't dress in other parts of my life. I think maybe a better way of putting it is, for most people have a BS meter, and they know when someone's not being real.
One of the things you said is that one of the values of recording these interactions for the sake of this project, and you never played these recordings for anybody else, and you told them that, but it allowed you to be more present for these conversations rather than busily taking notes, and I'm sure that made a huge difference for the better. As you're talking about this in your book, you say that that in some cases things would really leap out at you afterwards from the actual transcript versus in the actual moment when some of these things would be said, that yeah. Once a conversation had been actually transcribed from the recording and you would see those words, in a sense, on the stark printed page, they would have a very different impact on you. Can you give an example of a case in which that happened? And I suspect it happened quite a lot.
Yeah. Oh, let's see. I can't think of a specific example, but I know a few times there were conversations that were related to gender and just about my presence in the room as a woman that really startled me. And it's both startling that it didn't startle me in the moment, but also just as a woman moving through the world, it's just startling. The amount of sexism that passes as okay and as funny is pretty shocking at times.
Hmm. So things would be said that felt fairly acceptable in the moment,
yeah.
In the jocularity of an face-to-face interchange, and then you see those words on the page, and suddenly they really seem to carry a new connotation. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and when I am able to reflect on them in private, as opposed to being a person in the room whose job is to encourage conversation, to make sure that they're not throwing me out the door. there's certain things you have to do in order to be welcomed and accepted that just make it impossible to react in the moment as offended.
Sure. You also say that you encountered plenty of grumpy people in these conversations, but that, oddly enough, you learned a tremendous amount from some of the very grumpiest of all, even though these are really unpleasant conversations, and sometimes you sort of dreaded the thought of going back and talking with these people again, but you say, I learned things from their grumpiness. Can you explain that?
Sure. I think the people who were willing to be grumpy to my face told me a lot of things about St. Madison or urban elites or University of Wisconsin professors that I wouldn't have heard otherwise. And so I learned a lot from them that way. I mean, these are people who were less, you know, likely to have a filter on what they were saying. So they just gave it all to me. But I also, a lot of times these folks became the ones who were, maybe after the presidential election in 2016, like in the past few years, they've been the ones to be most of the groups kind of most happy to see me return. And I think we've kind of established a relationship of the following nature, where they gave it all to me. They were, you know, highly critical of things that they saw me as affiliated with, whether it be the university or urban life or urban elites, and they saw me come back repeatedly and realized that despite their criticism of me or people like me, that I still wanted to hear and listen. And now they're still grumpy at times, but they it's different in that they are also respectful of me.
So as you come away from this project, you of course spell out in your book, and I'm sure we'll talk on the 11th about much more of what you learned of what comprises this sense of rural resentment and how it has worked in terms of people's political lives. How much has this caused you to think about your own life, your own self, and your colleagues and peers who are, in a sense, the target of sometimes really blistering criticism and resentment? Do you see things about yourself and or your life and your community that maybe you did not see before? I mean, maybe another way to ask this is, do you see truth in some of this criticism and resentment that would never have occurred to you before? Or do you feel like, by and large, this is a matter of rural America misunderstanding urban America in the same way that they feel they have been misunderstood?
Oh, boy. Well, all of that is true, meaning there's huge misunderstanding in both directions. But I, yes, but I definitely think urbanites, yes, I'm a little afraid of overgeneralizing here, but there is definitely truth to the sentiment that some people in urban places look down their noses on people in rural places. And I think my experience since the presidential election of 2016 has driven that home for me, meaning here I was, someone who had written a book about rural folks in Wisconsin, and suddenly Wisconsin becomes a pivotal state in the outcome of the 2016 election, and people turn to me and say, what the heck happened in Wisconsin, and what the heck happened in rural Wisconsin in particular? And many of the conversations I have had with reporters, with other academics, just with people around the world trying to understand what's going on, I've sort of explained what I learned. And then people say to me, yes, but how can people be so stupid? How can people vote for Donald Trump? And I say, you haven't heard a thing I've said. You know, I mean, the amount of condescension towards people who are making choices that seem ludicrous to people in urban places is really disturbing. But I say, you know, there's huge misunderstanding in both directions, because for me, one of the big lessons from writing this book and then having it get such widespread attention is that the issue is not what's going on in rural America. I mean, for me, the issue is that there's something fundamentally wrong with our democracy when people in rural places And people in all kinds of places have this sentiment that nobody understands my challenges. No one's listening to me. I'm not getting the resources that I need in order to get ahead. And government, I mean, what's the point? It's clearly not working for people like me. And that I think, is the issue, that it's not exclusive to people in rural Wisconsin or rural people anywhere. But we, I think as citizens, we fail to see that. We fail to recognize that many of us are feeling overlooked and stepped on.
I would have thought that in this world where we are all so connected in a way that once upon a time was not possible, that we would really be entirely left to our own imaginations to understand what is life like in rural America, what is life like in urban America. And it's easy to jump to the conclusion that through the wonders of the internet, we're all going to almost magically and miraculously come to better understand one another. I mean, and part of me thinks that that still should be the case to a greater extent than it is, but it sometimes seems like this connectedness is being misused by certain people to deepen the divides rather than to cross the divides.
Well, I think that's a really great point, that the potential to use the technology we have in our hands to connect people is there, but is it being used that way currently? Great question. Sure doesn't seem like it. And I remain hopeful, though, that we can figure this out, that we can figure out how to be better connected with one another, and not necessarily so that we all agree, but that we have a chance to understand the lives of other people and the perspectives of other people, rather than just seeing them as something less than human.
Dr. Catherine Kramer, political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the author of this much-discussed book called The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness and the Rise of Scott Walker, published by the University of Chicago Press. Professor Kramer is going to be coming to the University of Wisconsin-Parkside next Wednesday, April 11th, for a special event called Building Bridges that will include a public reception at 5 o'clock and then her presentation at 5:30, followed by some dialogue and discussion. And a big part of that portion of next Wednesday's event will be Dr. Peggy James, who is the Dean of the College of Social Sciences and Professional Studies and Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And she has been a guest on the morning show before. She is here to talk about this Building Bridges project and this event next Wednesday. And also with her is one of the students who is in one of her courses, a junior political science major at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, K.O. Lemieux. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Glad you're here. So, Professor James, did you have something to do with the invitation for Professor Kramer to come to Parkside next week and for this event to occur? Tell us about that.
Well, last year, Parkside adopted a civic action plan of civic engagement, and we've actually been very active in terms of getting our students involved in the presidential elections and other voting activities, but what we wanted to do was to broaden our conception of what engagement actually means, and that was more in terms of citizenship, becoming involved with our communities. And after reading Kathy Kramer's book and adopting our civic action plan, with the help of Wisconsin Campus Compact, we were able to invite Kathy to come to campus. Originally, it was just Dr. Kramer, but we decided that it would really be interesting to do, on a small scale, a replication of her work and have some students get involved in it. So they will also be presenting next Wednesday on their results in Kenosha, Racine counties.
So that replication has already occurred, or it's kind of an ongoing project right now?
Yes, we started a couple of months ago and are still continuing. We have some last-minute work that we're doing before Dr. Kramer gets here, but we have had groups of students going out, similarly to Dr. Kramer, and going out into the communities and talking to small groups of people to ask what their attitudes and perceptions are of their situation.
Is this part of a single course, or this, or was this something just simply involving some of the political science majors at Parkside outside of any one single isolated academic course?
This is actually a course. The students are getting credit for this, and is based very heavily on an intense reading of Dr. Kramer's book and discussion of how to actually engage people in the community, finding those groups, and doing the presentation.
And one other question before we talk to K.O. about his experiences. Her book, of course, focused on rural consciousness in Wisconsin, rural voters and their attitudes. Is that also what you were specifically interested in this project with this course, or were you not necessarily interested in seeking out rural citizens of Wisconsin?
Well, we thought that Parkside's position in southeastern Wisconsin was really ideal for looking at divisions within particular groups. Some are rural and urban. Others are simply from different communities. So our students have specifically looked at groups on the east side of I-94, but also on the west side. So they've been interviewing people in Union Grove, Burlington, of course, in Kenosha and Racine, and also some student groups at Parkside, because we're finding that Parkside, because of its location, is actually a microcosm of this urban-rural divide as well.
Interesting. And when you think about urban versus rural, is there a particular benchmark that helps delineate that in your mind, and at least for the purposes of this particular study? I mean, for instance, does Burlington count as urban or rural, for instance?
My original idea was anything west of the I was rural, county, and anything east of the I was considered to be urban. I think the students are finding, however, that it's more complicated than that, is that we do have some rural folks or rural communities that are east of I-94, as well as some different ideas that are west. So I think one of the things we found is that it's a little bit more complicated than simply making a geographical division.
Interesting. Let's bring in the student that you've brought with you today, K.O. Lemieux, who is actually originally from Racine. I think you said a Case High School graduate. K.O., how long have you been interested in matters related to politics, and in a sense, what drew you to be a political science major at UW Parkside?
Well, I was always raised in a very political household. You know, I guess it really kind of started in 2008. I was in middle school, and I was just very not involved in the campaigns per se, but just always aware of what was going on and when Obama first got elected. And after that, I tried to stay relatively aware all through high school. I originally started as a history major, actually, at Parkside. And then I took like two poli-sci classes as a gen ed, and I fell in love with it because it's just the right amount of history, right amount of sociology, and I felt like I got a clear view of how the world works from it, so I just fell in love with the study.
Interesting. When you were a student at Case, for instance, did you feel relatively uncommon as a young person your age, so interested in and engaged in politics around you, or did you have plenty of peers who were also caught up and similarly interested?
Yeah, it was kind of rough trying to find people that were interested in the same way that I was. You know, there were one or two other people on the camp at the school that were as aware of politics as I was, but it wasn't. It certainly wasn't a common theme at all. So it was. It took a little bit. You have to find the right people that are interested in the same things, and it kind of build from there. You know,
right? And are you studying political science with any particular aspirations in mind, or are you simply studying it because it interests you so much?
I'm torn between a public policy focus, but I'm also double majoring in international studies as well. So that's probably where my focus is going to end up being.
Fantastic. So, Dr. James has already touched on this project, which involved you doing, on a little more modest scale, something like what Professor Kramer did with her study, and which led to her book, of course, The Politics of Resentment. First of all, real quick about the book itself, what is your own reaction to it, having studied it so thoroughly as part of this course?
Oh, I found the book absolutely fascinating. You know, I'm not big into, like, note-taking in my books, you know, but the second, like, we met with Peggy, we talked about it, ordered it. The second it got to my house, I started reading it, and I immediately grabbed, like, a set of highlighters, and I'm just like, this is fascinating, oh my. And a lot of the stuff she was talking about were things that I think I already knew, and I think a lot of people already know, but just putting it in the context of, you know, they have, like, of resentment, basically, just as simply put, made it just, it brought a sense of clarity to the situation, you know, because politics right now is obviously so noisy and so obviously polarized, you know, and just pegging it to the term resentment, I think really kind of helped explain a huge section of the problem that we have today in politics.
Yeah. Interesting. And I quite agree. I just feel like she, in a sense, put her finger on something and articulated something that all of us on some level had to know was there. Mm-hmm. But she put it so beautifully and, of course, backed it up with such extensive study of it. So explain kind of the logistics, the nuts and bolts, and jump in if you like, Professor James, in terms of these encounters that you and your peers have had with various citizens here in southeastern Wisconsin.
Yeah, so basically we split up into pairs. One person was meant to kind of be the order of the organizer of the conversation, while the other one would take notes and such. We'd also always ask the groups, like, if it's okay with everybody involved, if we can record. You know, that way we don't take anybody's words out of context, or, you know, it was all anonymous. We didn't write anybody's names down or anything like that. Just simple, like, you know, where you're from, things like that. So we got a good picture of it. And we just took a kind of similar approach to Ms. Kramer. We went to different places where we knew people, regular groups would congregate and see, like, okay, what can we do? Can we get a group of people together, hopefully that have already come together, you know, as a group? Or can we get, like, you know, there's a couple of people over here, a couple of people over here, let's get them together and see if we can build a community conversation with each other. Hmm. And just the things we found were absolutely fascinating, like what people brought up as being most important to them, what people kind of had no opinion about, and just, like, the places that we found that people met most regularly were, like you go to a coffee shop pretty regularly, but you don't realize that there's the same group there every morning until you go and you look for it, you know? Ah. It's like, oh, I've seen these guys here every morning, never really realized it, you know, until I've sat down and I've talked with them, and they're, you know, some of those fascinating individuals I've met. So
this is an observation I think you're making about yourself. Like, you've gone to some of these places, and only until this project did you realize that this place has regulars. And I'm probably one of those regulars, too, but you just hadn't stopped to think about it.
Yeah, you don't realize how your piece in an ongoing machine is in your day-to-day life until you stop and you look for it, you know?
Right.
Something also that the students have reported is that initially I think the students were a little nervous about going and engaging with people that they didn't know and wondering how they might keep the conversation going. But they've been reporting that once people are actually asked about what they're interested in and what their sentiments are, that they've actually just initiated the conversation on their own. In other words, our students have not had to prod anyone or ask any questions. Is that they've just continued to talk and actually led the conversation, which I think really follows up on what Dr. Kramer is saying, is when you really do ask people what they think and you're just willing to listen, that you'll get a lot of information rather than when you structure a particular question and ask the things that you're interested in.
Right. Well, and also if you are there more than anything to try to talk them out of supporting Governor Walker or talk them into supporting Governor Walker with no agenda like that at all, simply wanting to understand what they think and why they think that, that I should think makes all the difference in the world.
Exactly, and you'll find that they will actually volunteer a lot more information, not even information, but feelings and sentiments without even being asked, which I think indicates that there's a lot of people out there that are sort of suffering under what Dr. Kramer speaks about in terms of being condescended to, in that they're afraid to actually say what they're thinking. They're afraid that they'll be pigeonholed. They're afraid that they'll be labeled. But if you're just willing to listen, that there's a lot of opinions out there. I think that even as political scientists, I don't think we've actually correctly identified.
Right. Another thing that brings to mind is it seems to me that sometimes there is something very helpful simply in the act of articulating out loud something that you kind of feel deep in your gut. And sometimes I think people not everybody, but I think a lot of people come to a clearer understanding of some of their own attitudes. And maybe, for instance, somebody who never has thought of themselves ever as being racist because they never belonged to the Ku Klux Klan or they never used the N-word or whatever. And yet, if they are saying out loud what they honestly feel about, you know, feeling the encroachment of other groups that seem to be paid attention to more than they are, I mean, that maybe just by saying some of that out loud, they start to realize that maybe there at least is a vague hint of racism in some of these attitudes. And maybe not, but I mean, sometimes it offers a bit of clarity to us when we just say things out loud ourselves, as opposed to just
actually,
thinking them.
Something like that actually happened with one of Kao's interviews, and maybe he can tell you about that.
Yeah, me and my partner interviewed a group of gentlemen at a bar nearby, and I just noticed as we were talking, I think the conversation sprouted from Foxconn, and I don't know how detailed in the conversation I want to get, but just some of the terminology that he was using, and I found it interesting when listening to your interview with Catherine Kramer when she talked about like how much sexism is just like kind of glossed over. And I immediately spelled out to like, yeah, it absolutely is, because there was a few times when people might say something that's, you know, a little bit, scandalous, but I kind of gloss over it a little bit. And there was just one instance of what this gentleman said, and I kind of glossed over it. The second I walked out the door, I thought to myself, like, well, that's not really the terminology that you're using, or the way that you phrase that, you know, wasn't really acceptable, you know. And all of us kind of do that in our day-to-day lives, in trying not to cause arguments, because the whole our political debate has become so polarized, we're almost afraid of how it might escalate. You know, nobody wants to ruin the party. So,
right,
it's a really weird area, and that certainly sprouted up a few times in our talks.
Interesting. You know? Overall, Kao, from these conversations that you had and are continuing to have, what sort of general conclusions do you draw in terms of people's engagement with these issues, their seriousness, how articulate were people? I mean, what are your general impressions?
If I had to sum it up, I'd just say that people are fascinating, and like what you think people believe is absolutely not what they believe, because there were so many instances, like when I'm having a conversation with people, and with my group experience, you know, gathering a larger group together was, you know, sometimes more difficult at other times, at some times than others. So some of my groups were a bit smaller and a bit more intimate with in our conversation style. But as I'm talking with some of these people, they would I think that I'd had them pegged for one side of the spectrum or not, and then they would just say something completely out of left field, where I'm like, oh, okay. Some people would, you know, I would absolutely think like, oh, they're liberal through and through, but then they would say something along the lines of like the Second Amendment, and it would just be something that would go all the way in the opposite direction, or it'd be vice versa. I had several people that I thought were tried and true conservatives, and then they would say something along the lines of, you know, the Second Amendment is, you know, 200 years old or something
right.
like that.
Or gay marriage is okay or whatever.
Yeah,
it might be.
Yeah, and it's like, I know that people can occupy both sides of the spectrum very easily. People are very complex in that regard, but the issues that people were that would be, you know, liberals would be this way and conservatives would be this way. The certain issues like healthcare, education, and guns was the biggest thing, where like, you know, liberals would hold conservative views and conservatives would hold liberal views. I didn't expect that to be the issue. I know I'd find it, but I did not think that would be it.
It's certainly not how we see most big issues conveyed and portrayed right now.
Especially when you see a poll on CNN that just shows, like, you know, conservatives think this way, liberals think this way. You know, it's so much more complicated than that.
Yeah, and in some ways that gives us hope that what feels like this starkly divided country is, in a sense, not nearly as divided as it is sometimes made out to be. And, of course, Professor Kramer touches on certain forces who have, it is in their own interests to foster this sense of divisiveness, and maybe when we actually look at each other and what we actually think, maybe we're not as polarized as we think.
Talking to each other.
Right. Real quick, Professor James, then, what happens on next Wednesday after Professor Kramer speaks?
After Professor Kramer speaks at 5:30, the students will actually present the results of their work for about 15 minutes and actually bring it closer to home, so people will be able to see how some of the issues that Catherine Kramer has started to talk about across Wisconsin are actually happening here. Then we will have a table talk